Is this thing on? Hello and welcome back to another edition of Big Mouth, the talk show for people who possibly think a bit too much about music, film, telly and other stuff. As in Westworld, I am your host for the affair. My name's Andrew Harrison, and today, as ever, we have two special guests with us. Johnny Davis is the deputy editor of Gentleman Style magazine, Esquire. He's a former editor of The Face, and if you could see inside the studio now, you would see that he is wearing full Bowie Ashes to Ashes Pierrot costume as a Bowie nut. Hello, Johnny. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Andrew.
Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Thanks very much.
What's going on at Esquire at the moment? You just did your townhouse epic thing, haven't you?
We did. We did a sort of four-day event bringing the magazine to life in a townhouse in London. I had various people. Nick Hornby and various other speakers and events and live kind of shoe polishing and that kind of gentleman's stuff. It was good.
What were the shoe polishing?
Shoe polishing.
What were the high points? What was your favourite bit?
The high points was a guy who's written a book about the Nazis being on drugs, which I think...
This is a hot topic now, isn't it?
Yeah.
High Hitler, it said in The Guardian.
Exactly, yeah. He went down a storm at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. So a big turnout for that one.
Yeah. The best gag has to be the photo gag in Private Eye this week, which has a big picture of Hitler in the car with doing the salute and a balloon going, "It's Crystal Meth Nacht," which I quite liked.
They really put themselves to work there. I think we should do a Big Mouth townhouse. We should do a Big Mouth town shed. Four blokes in a B&Q lean-to arguing about Bowie beat size would be the way forward. Also with us and also returning to Big Mouth for his second shout is Andrew Mail, long-time contributing editor to Mojo, veteran of Select magazine in the 90s, and of course the great lost film magazine Neon. If you've got copies, dig them out. As well as an encyclopedic knowledge of rock and roll, Andrew has a hidden past as a lecturer in film studies, and he lives in South London with rabbits. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Hello. Very good.
How are the rabbits?
Marvellous, actually. They enjoy the cold weather, so they're okay. We bring them in when it gets too cold, but they're in very good spirits during bright, cold days.
Splendid. You've just broken the vow of a lifetime and joined Facebook, haven't you? You were a Facebook denier.
I've posted twice on it.
You're getting out of hand.
What's going... People seem underwhelmed by this.
Why did you break your Facebook silence and join the malaise?
Because I am now... independently employed, I think the term is. Yeah, so I thought it might help extend my business contacts.
Extend your brand.
Yes, exactly.
Brand mail. You've got mail. Also with us, twiddling the knobs and massaging the faders, is the Aphex twin of recorded spoken word. He's so much more than a producer. It's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, I'm just going to replace your voice with some sandpaper.
That would be nicer than my voice. Matt, have you recovered from the electrifying nail biter that was Liverpool versus Manchester United?
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, you enjoyed it because you scraped a point by parking a bus in the middle of Anfield, didn't you?
Yes.
It was what my nan used to call a damp squid. Right. Very much a damp squid. Anyway.
Is there any other kind?
Actually, no, there isn't. Well, you get them out, dry them in the sun.
Yeah.
Whack them to pieces on a piece of wood like the Greeks do for tenderising. Anyway, that's enough squid. For once this week, nobody in the world of pop culture has had the common decency to die on us and give us somebody who's doing enormous tributes on. But you can always rely on a certain person to puncture the silence. For the last few days, we've been treated to a 24-hour rolling Liam Gallagher as the lovable mop top has apparently gone all out to jump all over the launch of the Oasis documentary movie Supersonic. And also the Truth and Reconciliation edition of Be Here Now that we talked about the other day. Liam has compared his brother Noel to Hitler, a potato, a scary clown, and said he is the Ronnie Corbett of rock. Liam said that Oasis achieved in 3 years what it took the Beatles 8 years to do. And he told Radio...
Spit up.
And he also told Radio X that our kid's going round like I've stabbed his fucking cat. And he then said he wants them to get back together again for the sake of their mum. That was one day's set of headlines. Johnny Davis, yes. I mean, you can always rely upon Liam, can't you? Is this his job now? Not music, but a kind of court jester, cartoon figure, and supplier of material for news aggregators?
Well, at the start, it was quite amusing, wasn't it? And now it's kind of gone on, you know, the potato stuff and the photos of Noel and stuff that he was posting up were quite amusing. But it's gone on so long now, I just think it's a bit sad now, isn't it? Noel's it elevates himself by his dignified silence, I think, now.
Yeah, really. It's such turned into a kind of Viz cartoon strip, hasn't it, where Noel just sits there grinding his teeth while Liam... just sticks his arse through the window and sets fire to the kitchen just to get his attention. It's like they're stuck in this psychodrama of when they were little kids and they can't break out of it.
Exactly. Well, you mentioned the Esquire thing you mentioned at the start. We had Matt Whitecross talking about the Supersonic film, whatever, and there's a Q&A at the end, and obviously the first question was like, are they going to get back together? Mm. And his point was there's a Liam album coming, as we know, that he suggested was very good. I don't know. You can take it or leave that. I don't know. And there's another Noel album next year. So his point was for at least 2 years they'll be doing... their own stuff, so not on the horizon.
Mm. Under any other circumstances, you imagine that the PR will be tearing their hair out. But this is actually perfectly on brand for Oasis, isn't it?
I do like the fact that his the most recent interviews that he's done have been with the adjacent of his manager, who is also now his partner.
Mm-hmm.
It did remind me somewhat of Spinal Tap.
Yeah, not remotely Spinal Tap, is it? Yeah, sitting in. Andrew, is this endless coverage, is it a product of the endless need for snippety news? The fact that, you know, there are now, from the NME to every single entertainment website, there is a need for a very short, look what somebody just said half an hour ago.
Oh, and Twitter feeds that perfectly, doesn't it? Because each tweet from these famous people is a short bulletin. And I think there is, you know, I think you're right, there is a certain sense in which kind of you can find it wearying. But I do think also it wouldn't work if Liam wasn't very good at this.
Yes.
You know, and there is a wit there, you know. I mean, the interview that he did with Ted Kessler and Q, where he compared himself to a dog and Noel to a cat, was, you know, it was almost poetic. And
that's zen, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, he was saying, like, everywhere I go, I have to be taken out on a lead, and, you know, Noel's always jumping up on a wall and showing people his arse. You know? there is a wit and intelligence there, and you know, I do find that kind of Twitter is a different form of discourse, isn't it? And I think you're right. Once it feeds into the way in which news is covered, it's slightly problematic. But if you're looking at it as sort of pure entertainment, and also I do think it, as you say, it is the reason now to go and see that film, because it revives that kind of wibbling rivalry, kind of, you know, sort of tension. And in a way, kind of, there's different ways to read Noel's silence. You know, there is that kind of, is he being dignified in his silence, or does he literally not have any comeback on this?
He's just sitting there seething.
And also the other thing as well, it's a nice counterpoint to how dull that last Noel Gallagher album was, you know. And I think if you're looking for subtext, it's there. If you you know, if you're imagining that Liam listened to that album and all this stuff kind of bubbled to the surface, and now it's got a reason to come out, because it was like crack the dullness.
Yes.
When is the Liam Gallagher album coming out?
I don't know. Isn't it soon-ish? Who knows? Yeah. In shops soon.
Because that's not going to be. It's not going to be earth-shattering. Different.
I mean, it depends who he's made it with. I mean, the BDI records were sort of pointless, weren't they? Although I kind of felt for them, because they'd all been abandoned, they'd all been left on the island while Noel sailed away in his coracle. but you know, who knows? I mean, Liam. Well, he's under no illusions that he's a great musician, and so perhaps he's gone away and hooked up with the most amazing people. Who knows?
If we're talking about reviving the Oasis brand, you know, optimism followed by disappointment
was on brand. Yeah.
So you know, that's what they're reviving.
Alan McGee says, and his opinion can, you know, he's sometimes wrong.
Can go up and can go down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
says that if you think Liam can't write a tune, then you're mad, implying that he can. So.
Well, Little James was a banger, wasn't it? Yes. Johnny, I mean, you must. This kind of thing makes the whole concept of the hot interview kind of redundant, doesn't it? Because you're a consumer magazine, like, you know, I used to do, you know, Q and Select, you're doing Esquire now, you pull your tripes out to get the hot interview, and then it's just sliced and diced and it's on the NME the very next day, isn't it? I mean, does that make the whole thing somewhat pointless?
Yeah, I think so. I think particularly with, in some cases, yes. I think particularly with Noel and Liam, that's how we consume them, isn't it? We consume them. It used to be we consume them through the press, their interviews are better than their records, etc.
Yeah.
And now, as you say, through these little snippets, that's kind of, do you want any more? Not really. That's them, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, and we're kind of doing it now, aren't we? I've just done it literally with all the best bits. Is there any way to make it work for a magazine like Esquire? I mean, can you just dribble it out in a strategic manner?
Yeah, I think it depends on who you're interviewing. I think there's you know, if you're interviewing an actor, a Tom Hardy or somebody like that, then I think you can probably go to town on a sort of 5,000-6,000 word interview and you get something you don't get anywhere else. He's not, you know, in that example, he's not given to Twitter soundbites, is he? You want a kind of long thing where you hang out with him, etc.
I also think you do definitely feel a kind of, it's almost a physical shift when you move from, you know, reading stuff on Twitter, which I do, and then you get in kind of lose yourself in a 5,000 word feature, or even a 3,000 word feature. You do feel physically different. You do get, you know, the endorphin rush is different. I was reading, there was a piece in the current Empire, which was an interview with the people who made the French Connection. Oh, it's a cracking interview. And just the way in which they were allowed to, it was basically, you know, a bunch of old guys sitting in a bar talking about making the French Connection. And the way in which the sentences flowed and the way in which the piece flowed, you generally got a different physical response from reading it than you do. And I, you know, I love Twitter, as anyone who can see how many tweets I've got will, you know, kind of support. But it is a completely different feeling. It's a completely different kind of pleasure.
Well, there was a thing this week,
and I think you notice it more because of that contrast.
There was a thing this week that, surprise, surprise, showed that if you read newspapers, you have a greater assimilation of news than you do if you get it from aggregator sites and Twitter, etc.
And I can see that French Connection piece being boiled down to like a 50-word story that says, somebody was a dick on set, launched a stinging attack, and then, nowhere near the satisfaction. Mind you, let's be honest, we've all cheated, we've all built in the thing into a feature that you know is going to get picked up. Yeah. When I did a thing with Henry Cavill that plays Superman for Men's Fitness, of all things, because as you know, I'm a very big fitness person, I'm absolutely ripped. So I'm talking about Henry Cavill, and I thought, I've got to get something that's going to get a little bit of attention, outside the world of fitness. And asked him, when he was in the Tudors, he did all these endless sex scenes with beautiful models, he's playing King Henry, and I asked him, when an actor is doing these scenes, does a chap ever get a little bit overexcited, a little bit over-involved? And he sort of talked about the things that he had to think about to keep his mind on the job in hand. And this ends up going all around the world. It's in People magazine, it's in Us magazine, Henry Cavill's steamy sex scene secrets. And you sort of feel a little bit guilty about it because you sort of boxed him into it.
Job done, Andrew.
But also, job done, get all the clicks. Anyway, Liam and Noel, it's Noel I feel bad for, really, sitting at home being called a potato Hitler toad. I've got to say, when I
met more from them after the news.
Ronnie Corbett, I am Ronnie Corbett of rock and roll. So anyway, let's move on from that. With the first of our guests' editor's recommendations, we ask Big Mouth's guests to bring in a tune that they love at the moment, ideally new, but not necessarily so. Johnny, what have you got for us?
So this is a track by B12, which is not new at all.
It's one of my favourite vitamins.
nearly 25 years old. Described B12 or a Warp dance act. We're a duo now, one person. And described music-wise, described Wikipedia as intelligent dance music, which I think is probably about right.
Yeah. And why have you chosen this particular tune?
He's in only one of them, as I say, and he played a show in Camden last week or the week before, and it was kind of amazing. Amazing, one, because the music is great and still stands up, and two, because his reaction was brilliant. He was really genuinely kind of bowled over by the reaction of people, and it's only a 200. Capacity gig or whatever, and by the end of it, if he wasn't crying, then he was doing a very good impression of someone like trying not to cry, and it was just totally gratifying and amazing. The only other time I've seen that happen is when the reformed House of Love played Latitude 6 or 7 years ago and had the same reaction. They genuinely couldn't believe that people loved the songs as much as that, and it sort of reevaluates the idea of the reasons for doing something old again. Basically.
Yeah, that B12 album is fantastic. Electrosoma from 1993. This is Obtuse by B12. That was Obtuse. That's the name of the song. It wasn't particularly obtuse. By the techno outfit B12 from the album Electrosoma back in 1993. Bit of warp techno there for you. Okay, so let's talk about some new records. This artist is, of course, the voice of hard-won wisdom and experience. A lyricist whose searching perception of the aging process, and especially the male mind, is remarkable in music. His contribution to the body of contemporary song is unique and lasting, and he owes much of his acuity to the fact that he has deliberately separated himself from the daily hustle of the music business for a life of almost monastic contemplation. It is, of course, Nigel Blackwell of Half Mile, Half Biscuit, who released a compilation album of rare tracks called And Some Fell on Stony Ground shortly, this week I believe it is. First, let's talk about Leonard Cohen instead, who also releases an album this week. It's called You Want It Darker, and this is the title track. Leonard Cohen with the imperious You Want It Darker from the album of the same name, his 14th. Now, Johnny, you were just saying that was debuted on Peaky Blinders.
Apparently so. Who knew? Maybe the connection is hats. They were both big hat fans.
They rock a good hat.
They rock a good hat, all of them. Yeah.
Yes. And Andrew, you were saying that there's a Bowie connection to Peaky Blinders as well.
Yeah, apparently he got the title of Blackstar from Peaky Blinders. There's a scene in, I think, season one where Cillian Murphy scrawls a little black star in his notebook, and someone says, "What does that mean?" And he basically says, "It means that someone's marked, and it's a kind of symbol for death."
Wow!
And that could be someone reaching somewhat, but apparently Bowie was a massive fan. got in touch with the main guy and said, I love Peaky Blinders. I want you to use my music in the next season of it. He even had a took a picture of himself wearing a Peaky Blinders hat with the lasers in the brim. And he kind of wrote to Cillian Murphy about it and everything. So kind of I'm doing this sort of piece for, you know, Mojo on basically the weird year of Black Star and all its kind of strange interconnections. And that was, it was a guy on a David Bowie world. Yeah. Discovered that it's absolutely fascinating.
Let's get back to Leonard Cohen. That was from his new album, You Want It Darker. I personally only possess one Leonard Cohen album, and it's Leonard Cohen's Greatest Hits, The Best of the Beatles. Andrew Mail, what am I missing in the world of Leonard Cohen?
I mean, this album is this is all I'm thinking about at the moment, because I just think it's incredible. And I think, kind of like you, I kind of early Leonard Cohen I love, and there was something about the production of albums that are revered and have amazing songs on them, like, you know, I'm Your Man and Various Positions and everything. There's something quite kind of peculiarly kind of digital and kind of high end about the production, but and a kind of sickly sweet female vocalist in the backing that some people love,
and I
do not. And so kind of while I admired the songwriting, and while I've got, you know, I like all the early songs, like, you know, songs, albums like Songs of Love and Hate, there was something kind of that didn't quite sit with those mid period albums, and it's all gone in this album. There's just, you know, there's a purity, a kind of clarity of vision in it that's kind of quite scary, given that it's someone who's writing about, you know, his own mortality and his own kind of coming death.
I'm completely different. I came to Leonard Cohen through loads of songs that other people have covered, and then that album that came out of the last tour, the Live in Dublin album, they had that to stream on NPR for kind of like a couple of months beforehand, and I was listening to it. And it was all I was listening to for 2 months. And I thought, oh, brilliant, you know, what an amazing songwriter. And I went back and bought some of the really early stuff. And I couldn't stand them. Like Songs from a Room. There's a guy playing Jew's harp on Songs from a Room. Every track that I literally, if I can find who that was. But also his voice.
Just shut that racket up, for God's sake. Precisely. Stop it, will you?
The songs are brilliant. But his voice, I don't think, fits them on those early albums. Whereas now, it's perfect because it's so deep. It's like the voice of a kind of thousand-year-old man. It's Methuselah speaking truth to.
It is a new voice because he had to sort of really sort of relearn how to sort of sing when he kind of, you know, he was kind of ripped off by his accountants and he had to go back out on tour. And he had to kind of change all the sort of, you know, change the key that he sang.
That's going to test your Buddhism, isn't it?
Yeah, and absolutely. but that's another great thing about this album. It is about tested Buddhism. It is about thinking that you've gone to someone who has all the answers and you find them wanting, you know, in the last sort of, you know, years of your life. I'm sorry, I keep coming back to this album.
No, it's worth coming back to. Johnny, I mean, my introduction to Leonard Cohen was Neil on The Young Ones going, oh man, it feels like a Leonard Cohen song. Are you on the bus for Leonard?
I've got the same Leonard Cohen album you have. But having said that, it's a really good album. So the thing with this album is that, so he did an interview with The New Yorker where he basically said last week, this is the end, basically. I'm not going to tour anymore. I'm too ill to get out of bed, basically. I'm ready to die. He's written a letter to Marianne, as in So Long, Marianne, wrote to him and said, I'm dying. He wrote back saying, you know, I'm not long behind you. And so this whole, you know, thing for this album is that his last record, he's about to die. And it's a slightly kind of like, you know, there's been a few kind of death discs, some of them most famously Black Star, David Bowie, and also Johnny Cash was still, you know, doing his thing with it, with the kind of this cloud hanging over him. I don't know, is it possible to kind of review it without that? Does that matter? Is that part of it? I don't know, it becomes a weird thing.
That's clearly what it's about.
I think it's great. I think it sounds really modern. I think the choir on the lead single, You Want It Darker, is just brilliant. It sounds really current, and his lyrical concerns are really good. His delivery's fine.
There's a Paul Kalkbrenner techno mix of it as well. It's brilliant. It's fantastic. I was genuinely amazed at how much I enjoyed this.
It's a great record.
And it's the cliche to describe Leonard Cohen as bleak. I didn't think it was bleak at all. No. I thought it was.
I think there always has been that kind of mordant humour. I mean, kind of to be vaguely pretentious. Well, he kind of, there's almost like, you know, kind of Milton's devil. You know, who's got that idea that he's kind of, you know, he's been close to kind of, you know, God and heaven and everything, but there's a darker take on it.
But there's always been
and
that.
There's a poetry in that. That's what I mean.
And the humour has always been there as well.
It's always been there.
The Tower of Song being born with the gift of a golden voice and stuff.
But it's like kind of now he's got the real experience. You know, it's almost like he's kind of, he's peered over the edge, you know, and he's returned with something very special. Because I think the other thing as well that kind of, you know, is that, you know, is that clarity that he kind of comes with. You know, there's a kind of a clarity of vision and a clarity of phrasing that you think for somebody who is so kind of, you know, as he says in the New Yorker piece, so close to death, I think it's incredible. The other thing that I love about it, because he talks about kind of putting his world in order in the New Yorker piece, and he talks about kind of, you know, traveling light and leaving the table. And it's kind of, if you kind of know your old doo-wop and everything, it's got all these old doo-wop melodies. Yeah. It's got all this stuff. It's like the stuff that he's taking with him is the stuff on this record. Because you've got old klezmer melodies, you've got old doo-wop, and he's kind of, it's like, that's all I need. What's on this record is all I need to pass over.
Both of those forms of music as well will have massive death fixations, don't they? They're absolutely. You know, klezmer, obviously, is kind of, you know, fitting into an entire eschatological world, and, you know, doo-wop, well, people are always dying in doo-wop songs, always being stabbed.
Or Earth Angel.
That kind of thing.
The slight danger with it is if he it would be a great thing, obviously, but if he carries on in a kind of Clive James and Wilco Johnson of kind of... not dead yet. You know what
I mean? That was the situation with Johnny Cash, wasn't it? It was like, well, this is his last album. This is his next last album. You know, he's still here.
It's the third in a trilogy.
It's a fourth in a trilogy. It's a fifth in a trilogy. Yeah, and it actually got a little bit, I think, slightly indecorous with Johnny Cash, because those first few records that he made with Rick Rubin were so just incredible statements. And then it's a bit like, not that you wanted him to pop off, but you were thinking, this is the endless farewell tour is maybe not fair on Johnny Cash. But I think it's fantastic that, you know, as with Nick Cave, as with Richard Hawley, it's such a relief to hear music by and for, you know, grown men that doesn't either wallow in self-pity or come out with a whole load of sententious morality about the modern world. Okay, let's move on to another record that's coming out shortly. I alluded to this a little bit earlier. Half Man, Half Biscuit are putting out an Odds and Sods compilation, a sort of hatful of Half Man. It's called And Some Fell on Stony Ground. It's the B-sides and the tracks you can't find. This particular track is their cri de coeur about the most inexplicable football commentator of all. This is Bob Wilson, Anchorman.
Faraday, buy him a beer, and I'd love to meet the bloke who had the bright idea. Bob Wilson, Anchorman.
Half Man, Half Biscuit with Bob Wilson, Anchorman. Now, Andrew Mayle is very familiar with Half Man, Half Biscuit, but first I want to ask you, Johnny, what did you make of this record? Are you familiar?
I am familiar. I think it's great. It's great to be reminded of when indie sounded like indie music and was, you know, out of tune and can't sit and all that sort of stuff. It's proper, isn't it? It's great. Yeah. I just slightly think, who's going to buy this? But then, sort of trawling around the internet, I found out that the last record, Urge for Offal, was voted for by Reads of the Guardian as 2014's best record, despite the Guardian having never mentioned it. Yes. So there's an audience there.
A Bell and Sebastian Brits moment.
So. And quite right too.
But it's a really good record. I mean, you know, it's a John Peel band. Mm. With The Fall, he was famously said, they're always the same, always different. I think Half Man, Half Biscuit are just always the same, aren't they? Pop culture references, ramshackle guitars, football commentators. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. It's brilliant.
I'm not sure that they are always the same, actually, because like they have. I know it sounds terrible. They have developed, haven't they? They've sort of expanded their range. But it started out basically. It started out basically taking the piss out of daytime telly and being on the dole. And it's developed into this kind of picture of middle-class Britain. And what's it like being stuck in a B&Q on a Sunday? And, you know, what's it like when the bloke down the road insists on setting up a neighbourhood watch? And all these things.
This may be the wrong forum to kind of posit this point, but does the world really need another Half Man, Half Biscuit album?
My world does, Matt. My world does.
But this is the hard to find stuff. Yeah. You know,
this is the deep cut.
This is the stuff you can't get on the racks in Woolworths.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the bottom of the biscuit barrel. Andrew,
he's Wirral's Larkin, isn't it? Don't we? Yes. Pop Larkin. I mean, Philip Larkin.
Yes, you know? Yes.
And, that said, there's always been an ambivalence there for me, because the music, I would never choose to listen to that music without those lyrics. But I like the fact that it is an affront to pretension and sophistication, hence Irk the Purist.
Irk the Purist, yes.
And I like that. But, you know, the only reason I am listening to this is because of those lyrics. And I mean, there are certain tracks like Breaking News or National Shite Day, as you say, where they do something different. Mm. And they become my favourite tracks, because it's not that kind of ramshackle folk indie that they kind of, you know, that there is their default setting. But, you know, the reason to listen to it is to kind of, you know, to scrutinise the genius of those lyrics. What I would say, though, is I think Half Man, Half Biscuit LPs are, like, I mean, I sort of discovered them as a teenager, and like a lot of their teenage pursuits, it was solitary, because I think there's nothing more miserable than looking across to your co-listener when you're listening to a comedy album and waiting for them to laugh at the same point, you know, or when they don't, trying to explain the joke.
But because...
So I think that's the reason why they have that big fan following, because suddenly, you know, fans can connect with other people who get all the gags.
I mean, much like The Fall, as Johnny mentioned, the thing that, and I may be completely wrong and prejudiced in this belief, but if you're a fan of Half Man, Half Biscuit, you don't need any other music. You know, they're kind of like quite hermetically sealed. And I'd also say, like you just mentioned, the music isn't great. And does the world, do we really need a banjo version of Trumpton Riots?
I like the alternative take on that. I'm going to take issue. And I think they have actually learned to play a lot better than they did in the early days. I mean, it wasn't hard because they really couldn't play in the early days. But they have brought in kind of, you know, a sort of, you know, quite a decent take on folk. And actually, weirdly, on some of the recent records, they're kind of like AM radio rock thing, which I thought was completely beyond them, and they pull off obviously humorously. I like the fact as well that, you know, on this particular record, many of the songs are actually about something. Blood on the Quad is about being refused entry to, you know, a fancy Oxbridge college on the grounds of your poor accent and postcode, and fantasizing about going up and like performing a massacre. You know, it's actually about things that are really going on in the world. You know,
but they are at their best when they, like the Eno collaboration, when he's kind of like pouring scorn on Chris Martin, I think it was the most obvious kind of target for, you know, being a kind of superstar.
I know Ono and he knows Bono. I know Bono and he knows Ono and she knows Eno's phone goes thus.
Andy's in me undies line.
I've been to the Andy's in me and the Indies in my undies, yes. Yeah.
Referencing Nolan Liam earlier, is it true, I mean, you can sort of probably verify this, that the what is assumed to be a famous Noel Gallagher line, you know, about Liam, that he's like a man and with a fork in a world of soup. Doesn't that the original version of that feature in Bob Wilson Anchorman?
It does. I think
A man with a fork in a world of soup.
Yeah, it's raining soup, and I've got a fork.
Yeah,
and I wonder whether that's a Nigel original or whether that's some kind of an old northwestern
thing.
You know, grandma saying like sky blue pink with Finny Eddie Border, which nobody really knows what it means.
But I think the other thing that's beautiful about them is that kind of the delicacy of their kind of, you know, the observational humour. You know, kind of when you're holding tea and toast and there's no one else around, do you switch the kitchen light off with your chin?
Absolutely, yes. Careful now, that swan could break your arm. Yeah. it is very, very acute, and also the musical gags are brilliant as well. Like on the blues pastiche, you know, woke up this morning with hair like Brian May. He talks about going down to the crossroads, and then just quickly you just hear ding, 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 and then straight back.
But that does, you know, when was that? At what age will people stop recognising that musical riff for the Crossroads theme?
I think Half Man, Half Biscuit's audience is ageing with the band, and I think we will all die knowing that thing. I don't think they're really taking any listeners off Justin Bieber, are they? I don't think that's not the purpose of the exercise.
And the other question I have is, has a review of Half Man, Half Biscuit ever used the title What the Wirral is Waiting For?
No, but they did call an album Four Lads Who Shook the Wirral, which is... anyway, Matt, what you need to understand about this, because I know this will enable you to relate to it, this is essentially rap music, Matt. It's the music of the streets. No, it's telling the stories of the streets, man.
I think the lyrics are great. It's just the musical kind of... the willful kind of musical pedestrianism kind of negates it slightly for me.
Well, I love them, and that's all that matters. Are you converted, Johnny? Well, you already love them. You're going to put them on the front of a Esquire?
Yeah, why not?
Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, let's move on to another editor's recommendation. Andrew Mayle, what have you for us?
I genuinely don't know. It's a track called Herzog on the Bus by a group called Soft Grid. And I was at home trying to finish something and trying to find a track for this show. And I was saying to my wife, Colette, I said, I can't find anything. I don't know what to play. And she just comes in, picks up the record that's on the top of my pile and go, what about this? Herzog on the Bus. That sounds quite good, doesn't it? Listen to that. And I said, it's not going to be any good. It's not going to be any good. It's fantastic. They're a young Berlin trio. You can hear bits of post-punk. You can hear bits of post-rock. It's beautifully produced with amazing sound. And I wouldn't have heard of them if I hadn't been in this position trying to think of a track to choose. And my wife came in and said, what about this lot? They sound good.
Okay.
So I think that's the beauty sometimes of these things, that it kind of, you know, that we are so overwhelmed by music at the moment, and kind of there is so much that just slides off the table,
yeah.
goes in the bin, and you don't see it. And that's kind of how I found these, that they, you know, they suddenly came into my world, and I think it's terrific.
Okay, well, stop. Oh, wait just a minute, Mr. Post Rock. Here is Soft Grid, Herzog on the Bus, chosen by Colette Mail, not Andrew Mail. Soft Grid and Herzog on the Bus, as chosen by Andrew Mail, or more accurately, Mrs. Andrew Mail. That sounds like a pre-war Liverpool insult, that, doesn't it? Shut up, Soft Grid. You, Soft Grid.
It does.
So,
Herzog on the Bus.
Herzog on the Bus, yes. Now, apropos of nothing, the other day I was reading friend of the podcast, Mike Shawcross, on Facebook, possibly in an attempt to dispel the misery of politics right now, and he was idly spotting MPs whose names sound like they ought to be in the Wu-Tang Clan. So we thought we'd try it. You know, MPs act like they don't know. Who's got a name that sounds like it should be a member of the Wu Gambinos? I'm going to kick off with Bill Cash. Conservative stone. If there isn't already a Wu-Tang member called Bill Cash, then there probably ought to be, shouldn't there?
Surely his campaign bus, when he drives around, should be playing Bill Cash Rules Everything Around Me.
Yeah,
totally. Absolutely. Yep, that's very
can
good.
I have Thangam Debonair?
You absolutely can.
Lib Dem for Bristol West.
Yes, sounds like with a name like that, it should be like Ludacris or, you know, Chameleonaire or something.
Absolutely. And there's Maria Ghostface Miller, Conservative MP for Conservative MP for Old Dirty Basingstoke.
Oh, amazing. Have you got any of those, Johnny?
I can't. I'm out.
Okay, that's all right. Well, I've got loads in. Where's Crispin Blunt, Conservative Reigate, you know, blazing up with meth there.
I knew that you'd come up with the worst puns. You and Andrew would come up with the worst puns possible. So apart from the fact that it's always struck me that that the Beastie Boys in a track called Shadrach rapped about UKIP's only MP,
yep.
because there's a line about, like, Mario Andretti, because he always drives his cars well.
Well,
very good.
Douglas,
very good.
Of course. But I did. There is the Wu-Tang name generator on the internet, and I put in some of the, you just put in your name, and you get your Wu-Tang name out. So Jeremy Corbyn was given the name of Master Knight. the Brexit trio, Dr. Liam Fox, I think, because he's got Doctor in his name, was called the Swami. David Davis was Amateur Specialist.
That's actually quite correct.
That's
isn't
that? Yeah,
that's very accurate.
Theresa May was Fearless Knight, and the best one was Boris Johnson, who came up with her, who is now for always to be known in our house as Unlucky Magician.
Yeah, that's good.
That's also surprisingly accurate, isn't it, Rick? You just see him standing there with you doing rap hands on a Pen and Pixel record cover with just a catastrophe before him, smoking ruins of a city.
Like, I branched out as well. I thought of some names that were kind of more like Wu Gambino aliases.
Yes.
So as along with Sir Bill Cash, there's Sir Greg Knight as well.
Sir Greg Knight, yeah.
And Julian Sturdy. Iron Michael Fabricant.
Yes.
Jack Lopresti.
Jack,
I think also the Honourable Victoria Prentice sounds quite Wu Gambino as well.
It does, yeah.
But well, also there's Marcus Fishscale.
No.
Marcus Fish.
Well, yeah. I had a further nose round as well, and Rebecca Powell, our Liberal Dem Taunton Dean, sounds like Sister Soldier or something. I also thought that the Labour MP for Rotherham, Sarah Champion, sounds very dancehall, the Champion sound coming at you. And of course, let's not forget Alan Mack. The return of the Alan Mack, Conservative haven't. You know, I like the idea of teaming up Crispin Blunt with Mike Caine, Blunt and Caine, you know, like Sea Money and Murderer and all those guys. So, of course, we cannot let it go without pointing out the existence of Sir Alf Dubbs. Well, grimy.
Have you not got Andy Slaughter down there?
No, actually, Andy Slaughter with an A on the end, yeah. But I think the queen of the lot is obviously Gisela Stewart of Edgbaston. The Gisela Stewart. So shout out, I believe, to Mike Shawcross, who we pinched that one from. It takes a lot to entertain, and sucker MPs can be a pain. We're coming to the end of the show, and that means that it is time for Closing Time Chatter, where our guests pass on the story or the idea or the feature that's been obsessing them this week. Johnny Davis, I believe that Netflix has been burning your brain this week.
Yes, so this is a rumour that's been around for a little while, but it seems to be gathering pace, that before Christmas they'll finally do the one thing that we all want Netflix to do, which is an enable the download function, so you can have Netflix content on your phone or your whatever tablet and carry it around with you, which is kind of the sort of the will beat everything else in terms of viewing, won't it? That'll be always glued to glued to endless Netflix stuff. And there's also sort of a race of spending heating up in that they announced they're going to spend $6 billion on content for 2017, Netflix, which dwarfs Amazon's $3.2 billion. And apparently even one episode of The Crown on Netflix cost $2.5 million. So the ludicrous, the amounts of money being spent are kind of crazy, but it's interesting to see where it'll go for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible to imagine that a basic, simple subscription service can provide such an enormous war chest. And it is actually, with few exceptions, it's doing the best telly around at the moment, isn't it? I mean, obviously, me and Matt are addicted to Luke Cage and anything related to that. But, you've got, The Get Down, you've got, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, you've got, you can live entirely in a Netflix world.
It's amazing. I think the only danger is that our expectation will be so high that can it continue like this? And there's just so much good stuff of such length and such quality that it's kind of a bit boggling.
I mean, the other danger has to be as well that terrestrial channels and broadcasters who we've turned to for the last kind of like 30 or 40 years will just find themselves being outbid. Yeah. It's already happened that Amazon has obviously taken the Top Gear crew. They've also picked up Ripper Street when that wasn't extended by the BBC and are now selling it back to the BBC with exactly the same kind of cast and crew and whatever. So I think it's brilliant that Netflix are doing this because I really like their stuff. I think there is a kind of slightly bigger picture which we need to be not concerned about but aware of.
But actually, looking further down the line, we talked about this on a podcast a few weeks ago, the fact that the BBC is going to have to put more and more of its shows out to tender. And it's starting with things like Songs of Praise that perhaps is not central to the Big Mouth experience. But apparently, pretty much everything, with the exception of News, within the next 11 years, I believe, is going to have to go out for tender. So are we going to end up in a situation where Netflix is making major TV drama for the BBC? Netflix going to make Doctor Who? I'd be perfectly happy with that.
Yeah, maybe.
There's astonishingly high production values and, endless story arcs.
And also, what happens once you take it away from that kind of the BBC editorial control? Do things benefit from it? How much of that is in play,
I think, from what I understand of it, the BBC would still have brand control over everything, so that they can pull a plug at any time and they'll still have editorial oversight. So I'm not sure you'd necessarily see, kind of endless scenes of Boardwalk Empire style violence.
But also, like the Matt's point, I mean, you do think, how does it affect kind of old school sort of cable sort of, sort of sites of quality like HBO as well, because where people kind of are basically kind of looking at their, in the US, are certainly looking at their cable subscription and thinking, it's only really HBO that I'm paying this for.
Andrew, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
Well, it's been interesting how kind of emotional the sort of exit of Obama has been, how people are saying how much they're going to miss President Obama.
This guy that they hated for 8 years, they're now going to miss him. Yeah, thanks for that,
isn't it? But what I'm going to miss is Joe Biden, or more specifically, The Onion are going to miss Joe Biden, because one of the delights for the past, since 2008 has been their ongoing affectionate love affair with the vice president, and how they basically see him as this kind of teenage stoner, sort of, kind of like knocking about the White House with nothing to do. And so kind of, I was just kind of looking at the most recent, headlines and Onion stories about Joe Biden. And it's like, Secret Service shut down Biden's unofficial White House tour operation. Biden regales DNC with story of 80s girl band Vixen breaking Hard Rock's glass ceiling. Biden lines up sweet summer gig installing above-ground swimming pools. And Biden quietly asks Obama to pick him up some of those real throwing stars. And the thing that I was kind of looking at it, and when it started out, it was much cruder. It was about him going on about all the chicks he'd banged and everything. And you can obviously tell as it's gone on, the people who write, and I think it's obviously one team who works on the Biden stories, their affection for him has grown, and a kind of kind of end of summer melancholy has crept into the narrative. And it's really, I actually genuinely did find it quite moving, but also some of the funniest stuff on The Onion,
It just makes you fear for, what they're going to... In the unlikely event, touch wood, please, God, event of a Trump presidency, doesn't that just defeat The Onion? There's nothing funny left to be said.
Well, that's it. I mean,
An Onion story has come true.
You could make similar stories once Trump comes into power, but they wouldn't be funny, you know.
Yeah.
If it was Trump arrives early to set up State of the Union fog machine,
it'd just be like, yeah.
Yeah, and, I can believe that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I saw a story on The Telegraph yesterday about how Andrea Leadsom's plan for the future of Britain's economy was tea, biscuits and jam, and I thought it was News Thump or The Daily Mash, and it was The Daily Telegraph. The reality is just destroying and defeating satire,
that
isn't it?
That story was circulated on Twitter by, I can't remember, apologies to him, which comedy writer said under the tweet, satirists start new campaign for can we have 2016 back, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, or just I resign. What's the point anymore? Matt, what's your closing
Well, I too have been terrified of what's going on in America, so I've reverted totally to the 90s, which basically involves watching three episodes of The West Wing from start to finish every night, just to kind of get my blood pressure down. But also, I've found a rather fantastic 8-hour 80s and 90s hip-hop mix that is available for download from a DJ called Eric the Tutor. which is absolutely brilliant.
And another member of the cabinet.
Yeah. And it covers all bases. It starts with Back in the Day from Ahmed. It's got Parents Just Don't Understand in it. It's got Bismarcky, but it's also got kind of things from Raekwon and the Beatnuts and Gangstar sites. And it's 301 tracks. And basically, you know, if you have an 8-hour working day, you could essentially just start it at the beginning, put your headphones on, and that would see you all the way through to 6 p.m.
Are you going to stick that on the Facebook page?
I certainly will.
So that the listeners can have
a discussion. Yeah.
That's splendid. Well, my closing time chatter is nowhere near as colourful, but it's just the fact that a survey came out yesterday on what people think of the cost of streaming, and the conclusion was that £10 a month is too much for streaming.
What?
£10 a month for all the music ever made by anybody ever available to you at all times is apparently too much. And this just really pissed me off, actually. Yeah. So what the hell is the matter with you people? Not least the fact that, you know, if you compare it to your monthly data bill, nobody's paying £10 a month for all the crap they consume off their mobile phone. You know, £40 a month mobile data bill has just seemed to be a basic necessity, like toilet paper and, you know, tea bags kind of thing. Nobody ever bitches about that. But apparently £10 a month is too much for streaming. And the idea that the streaming industry, which is already distributing, you know, a small sliver of a button to artists, is going to reduce still further its incoming revenues seems crazy to me. It sort of made me think about the fatal flaw in looking at the world in terms of the customer is always right, because we've been told for the past 35, 40 years that the customer is always right. And I think we're increasingly going to come around to the fact that the customer sometimes is a complete entitled idiot and needs to be told that things cost money and are expensive. So if you're listening, go and subscribe to Spotify or Apple Music or something and spend money on music. By the way, it was an online survey, so perhaps self-selecting. Yeah, that's nice. Not a proper representative one, but it's still worth talking about. But anyway, that's our show. In honour of Donald Trump, we thank our guests bigly. Thank you, Andrew Mayle of Mojo and Johnny Davis of Esquire magazine. We really have all the best guests, and they said a lot of things. The show's going to be great, and Mexico's going to pay for it. Remember, you can hear this episode again and all of our episodes at audioboom.com. Just go there and search for Big Mouth. You can subscribe via the iTunes Music Store. Just go there and search for Big Mouth. And while you are there, if you give us a star rating, it helps us, because we are the Uber of podcasts and we depend upon your star ratings. And of course, don't forget to follow the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/BigMouthUK. So there's only one thing left to do, and that's for me to do my editor's recommendation. This is a band from Birmingham who do all of the indie disco hits in the country bluegrass style. They're called Independent Country. Their album is called Trailer Park Life. Hey. And it's on Bandcamp now, so go there and throw them a few quid. Here is their version of Rope for Luck by Happy Mondays. Have a listen, and we'll see you next week.
I wrote for luck, an ace in the U. I asked for juice, you give me poison. I ordered lime, you formed a queue. Trying to think hard, is anything else you can do?